The following is a repeat broadcast of Health Matters, and no phone calls will be taken tonight.
Good evening and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, your host for this edition, and we'll be talking about facial plastic and general plastic surgery. Specifically, we'll be talking about both reconstructive surgery as well as cosmetic procedures. There are a number of reasons why people may opt for surgery, whether it be reconstructive or plastic surgery to enhance their appearance. Perhaps it's just because they're not quite happy about some aspect of how their body looks, or perhaps it may be necessary after an illness. Joining me in the studio to talk about plastic surgery techniques and to tell us a little bit about when plastic surgery may be a good or bad idea is Dr. Paige Bundrick, ear, nose, and throat surgeon and facial plastic surgeon at LSU Health Sciences Center, and Dr. Forrest Wall, plastic surgeon with the Plastic Surgery Center in Shreveport. Welcome.
Hi, Sandy. Thanks for having us.
Hey, Dr. Katz. How are you?
Hey, good. Thanks for coming on this evening. There's a big topic, very popular, lots of TV shows about this stuff. So first off, I want to talk a little bit about your training. Now, you're both plastic surgeons, but Dr. Bundrick, you specialize in face, and you, Dr. Wall, are more of a general plastic surgeon, correct?
That's correct. So I did 5 years of ear, nose, and throat training and did an additional fellowship in facial plastic surgery. I'm a board-certified facial plastic surgeon. So our paths to get to where we are today were a little bit different.
Okay. And Dr. Wall, now, how's your training different, let's say, than Dr. Bundrick's?
Well, I don't like the word general plastic surgeon.
Oh, okay.
I'm just a board-certified plastic surgeon.
Okay.
So we cover the whole gamut of all plastic and reconstructive surgery.
I see. Yeah, so when I said general, I guess I meant holistic, whole body, that sort of thing.
Sure, sure.
Whereas I guess Dr. Bundrick, she limits her practice to the face, and you, let's say, your practice is unlimited.
Correct.
How's that? That's okay, good. Very good. And so you mentioned board-certified plastic surgeon. So now, is the board certification different for you guys?
It is. They're completely separate boards.
Okay. Now, how important is it to go to a surgeon who is board certified?
Well, our board and our society has spent millions of dollars trying to educate the public on the importance of being a board certified plastic surgeon and not being something that in this country you can call yourself whatever you want. Some people call themselves cosmetic surgeons, and there really is no definite career in training for a cosmetic surgeon, but yet they still have their own boards and they've made up or their own qualifications that are really not recognized by you.
So can a non-plastic surgeon perform those procedures as a scope of their practice, even if they're not specifically trained in plastic surgery?
Yes, they can if they can find a place that allows them to do it.
So
patient allows them to operate on them.
And a pediatrician potentially could do some sort of a cosmetic procedure if they wanted to?
It's happening all over the place. I think a lot of people have been seeing in Florida a lot of these patients that are getting stuff done in these chop shops kind of places, and they're getting unknown type of physicians or even not even physicians to do procedures on them.
Wow. So, okay, so this is a really important point to bring up, is that if you're going to have some sort of a procedure done or treatment done to affect your appearance, it's important that it be somebody who's specifically trained and preferably boarded in this specialty, so you make sure that you're getting a quality and safe procedure. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
So, Dr. Bundrick, in your practice, what would you say are the most common surgical and non-surgical procedures that you perform?
The most common thing that I do, I would say, is rhinoplasty or a nose job. I do it for functional, which means breathing reasons, and also for cosmetic reasons. A lot of people don't know that their insurance will cover a nose job to help them breathe better. So I'm trying to start a campaign to raise awareness about how's your breathing. We can help that.
So how does somebody know if their breathing isn't good and it's because of their nose?
Well, you take a deep breath through your nose, and is the air air flowing like it should be. A lot of people, their spouse will complain of snoring. And also every stuffy nose is an allergies. A lot of times it's an anatomic problem that has to be corrected with surgery. And no amount of Flonase or Breathe Right nasal strips will help.
Okay. And, okay, let's say somebody needs to have a rhinoplasty for functional reasons, or let's say they want to do it for cosmetic reasons. What would be the youngest age that you would suggest reasonable for them to undergo that surgery?
It's recommended that you wait until you're about 16 years old. We want the face to be as close to full size as possible. By doing the surgery, you could, in theory, disrupt the blood supply to facial growth plates and alter the growth of the face. So we want them to be as close to adult size as possible, which is about 16.
Okay. Now, I imagine there's kind of like this perception of the ideal nose. How often do you get someone coming to you and say, yeah, I hate my nose. I really would like to have it smaller or without this bump or whatever. And, you know, I mean, what's the criteria after which you say, you know, it's really, your nose is fine. You really don't need this. Do you ever encounter that?
I do. For the most part, I find people are actually really reasonable. I go through the patient, you know, the aesthetic standards. I am obviously a facial plastic surgeon, so there are certain, you know, measurements and qualities of the nose that we do consider aesthetically appealing. And so I try to go through that, methodically. And from there, I can decide with the patient, we can do some facial morphing to decide what would be the best option for them.
Okay. And any other procedures you typically do very commonly, whether it be surgical or non-surgical?
Sure. I do a lot of eyelid surgery, eyebrow surgery, and then a lot of facial aging procedures. So facelift, neck lift, upper lip lift, eyelid lift, things like that.
A lot of heavy lifting.
Heavy lifting.
So of those, you mentioned that sometimes the rhinoplasty or the nose job can be covered by insurance. Any of those ever covered?
Absolutely. A lot of times eyelid and eyebrow surgery can be covered by your insurance. I typically have you seen by an ophthalmologist to get measurements, and they can do visual field testing to see how much the eyelids are obstructing your vision. Typically, this is people who do have a lot of excess skin in the upper eyelids where it's sitting on the eyelashes, causing a heaviness when they're reading. That's what a lot of people complain of, is when they look down and they're reading a book, that their eyelids feel heavy. And that typically is a good indicator that your insurance is going to cover it.
Okay. And what about ears?
So ear surgery for cosmetic reasons, specifically the ear pinning, is not covered by insurance.
What's ear pinning?
Ear pinning is, technically we call it the lop ear deformity, but I'm sure everyone has known a kid growing up that just had big ears. Colloquially, some people call it Dumbo ears, which is an unkind thing to say. But this is something that I'm really, really passionate about. There have been a lot of studies to show that children who are bullied because of their ears growing up don't do as well just in life in general. They don't make as much money. They're not as successful. Bullying is a really big deal. So I am very passionate about getting the word out that this is something we can help. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that if a child is born with this deformity, a lot of times you can pick it up in the first few weeks of life. And we have a non-surgical procedure called ear molding that we can apply a mold in the clinic, no pain to the child, it's non-surgical, and it's covered by insurance, and we can reshape the baby's ear.
Wow. Without surgery.
Without surgery. The ear molding is a wonderful procedure. I'm really passionate about it, and a lot of people don't know about it.
Pretty neat stuff. Dr. Wall?
I should add in that I do all that stuff, too.
Do you? Okay. Well, I think we established you are unlimited. Okay. So now, let me ask you, of the things that that you see, what would you say are the most common procedures, both surgical and non-surgical, that you see in your practice?
Well, non-surgical, of course, is the fillers and the botulism-type paralytic toxins or that paralyze wrinkles or get rid of wrinkles.
Yeah.
Those are the most common procedures done in the United States cosmetic purpose-wise right now, which is non-surgical and done in the office. Surgical-wise, it's usually stuff done with the breast, either breast enlargement, breast reductions, or breast lifts.
Yeah. So you find, in general, women tend to be unhappy with the status of their breasts probably more than anything else?
Well, I always tell people that ask me that I have a wonderful job because the grass is always greener. So the women that don't have breasts want them, and the women that have them, big ones, want them smaller, and then those that are medium all want them lifted. So,
and what about the men?
Well, that's a different subsect. We do get a few patients of stuff called gynecomastia, which is male breast development. A lot of that's from hormones when they're growing up, but we see a lot from medications they take that get gynecomastia or male breasts, and drugs that they might do.
What about after like excessive weight loss?
Well, we see a lot of bariatric or weight loss patients, and sometimes we do have to do mastectomies or breast reductions on very large males.
Yeah, I'd imagine so.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
We actually have our first caller. We have Kevin from Shreveport. Kevin, welcome to Health Matters.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
I had a question, I guess, for one of the doctors. I used to do a lot of triathlons, and I've got some injuries. Just had a shoulder surgery the other day, and I'm not in the same shape I used to be. If I want to get a little here and there to stay in that shape that I was in my 30s, I'm coming up on 40 soon. I mean, I'm 50 soon. What's my recovery time, and what's involved in the recovery?
Can you clarify for just a moment, Kevin? What do you mean a little something?
You know, the side handles aren't as tight as they used to be. Maybe the shirts don't fit the same way they used to be. I just want a little bit of maybe clean up around the love handles. I mean, is it something that I'm not going to be able to work out with, or I'll still be able to ride my bike and swim and run? Or, I mean, how long does it take to recover from something like that?
Okay, so me and Kevin want to know the answer to this question. Dr. Wall.
Okay, well, Kevin... If you're not in tip-top shape, and you come in and you want a little liposuction, which is what it sounds like what you're describing, usually you can get back to normal activities within 3 to 5 days. But you will see, I'll limit your activities physical-wise for a couple weeks, and then I have you wear some compression garments under your clothes for 4 to 6 weeks. But usually you can get back to working out and running and getting back into your triathlons within a couple weeks.
What about the skin after a procedure like that? Is it going to look normal? Do I have to worry about my girlfriend not, you know, liking that? Or is it going to look funny? Or, you know, I'm in the gym or something. Am I going to have to worry about the scars? Is it going to be like a wrinkly skin look?
Well, that is the risk of doing any cosmetic procedure. There's always risks associated with anything, and it just depends on how tight and how elastic your skin is to rebound from this surgery. And once you get evaluated in a consultation, you can better we can go over what your results might appear to be like. But without really examining you and looking at your skin elasticity, it's hard to describe. If you're a triathlon that's in tip-top shape, I would doubt you had too much skin. So I would imagine that you would be pretty good.
I'd be good. I'd look like I used to,
yes.
Or close to it.
Well, best of luck getting back to it, Kevin. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for calling in.
Bye.
So that's an interesting question. I understand there's a number of techniques to addressing, I guess, liposuction or some other form of fat removal. There's freezing, laser, surgery. What are the different options, Dr. Wall?
Well, there's a stair step technique, and this is the hottest thing in plastic surgery, probably our cosmetic plastic surgery right now, is the different approaches to reduce or remove some fat. Non-surgical wise, there's a lot that are being promoted. A lot of people probably have seen this, the chilling or freezing of fat what's it? Cool Sculpting, I guess, is the most common one that out there. It's got pluses and minuses. I don't really do that. I have something else that I prefer. It's called the Vanquish Machine, which is a radial frequency, which I think has more benefits than the Cool Sculpting and is more cost effective too.
Now, can you also use that machine to tighten the skin after liposuction?
It will the radial frequency will tighten it up to a certain extent, but there's even newer machines out there. There's always going to be a new machine, but there's even newer machines out there now that use radial frequency across the skin that are claiming they have 25% improvement of skin tightening than more traditional methods.
So these are non-surgical techniques?
Well, that one I'm talking about right now is considered surgical because you have to make a small little incision, but it's minimally invasive, I guess.
And the freezing, how about that one?
The freezing is non-surgical, but it is extremely painful and requires multiple treatments.
Do either of these require some sort of sedation or anesthesia?
The ones non-surgical do not require anesthesia.
Okay. And then who would be a good candidate for that? I mean, is there a limit to how much fat you're having to address as far as a limitation for one procedure or the other?
Yes. These non-surgical techniques are very limited, and that's why not everyone will qualify or be a good candidate for these procedures just because of the skin, the weight, the amount of tissue you're trying to remove. So that's why you have to come in and have
a consultation. Come in for an evaluation, sure.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
We have another question, a caller coming in, Hunter from Shreveport. Hunter, welcome to Health Matters.
Hi.
Is this Hunter?
Yes.
Hi, Hunter. What's your question for our doctors?
Yeah, well, I work out all the time. I do tons of cardio, and I do my best to eat healthy, but I still have some trouble areas around my bottom and my thighs. And I have a question for the doctors. I know that implants, butt implants, or another procedure might be the way to go to lift up that troubled area around the back, the top back of the thighs and the lower part of the hiney. I guess my question is what would be the best procedure for that?
Well, you're referring to, I guess, it's a lot of exposure on TV now about the BBL, the Brazilian butt lift, is what I think you're describing. I perform those procedures, and they're very popular, and you can see them on TV and read about them. But they're very hard to do, hard to get a good result. And I end up telling most of my patients to go do a lot of squats and
instead
lunges.
Or after?
Instead.
I see.
Because
are there a lot of complications potentially associated with that procedure?
Well, our the Brazilian butt lift is traditionally now considered fat injections into the gluteal or buttock area. And our society has come out recently in the last year and a half or so and described it as the most potential for having surgical deaths.
Okay.
So, yeah, it has some risk to it.
So now, are there actual implants that are placed sometimes or perhaps in the past? Was that a technique that was used?
Yeah, I still do gluteal implants or butt implants, and I just tell every patient that is the most painful surgery you will ever have, and the patients I do, some of them get actually very depressed for an extended period of time because of the pain. So they have to think long and hard about it, and it's raw. It has potential for complications too. I probably talk 10 patients out of doing that versus everyone that I operate on.
Gotcha. And what about the other sites where you do implants? You mentioned breasts. What about pecs, calf, any other sites where you do implants?
Well, those used to be very popular in the 90s. Since the new millennium, we have not seen as many males that usually want pec or calf implants. I would probably contribute that more toward their steroid use. They're able to get...
They're able
muscles.
To get what they need.
Yes.
So are there risks associated with implanting let's say, foreign objects into the body, whether it be in the any of those sites or let's say the breast?
There's always risks with when you put a foreign body in anywhere of the body. They can get infected, they can get exposed, they can move or shift. So, yes, there's always, and I've seen all of them. So the mere fact being in a car wreck, I've seen several ladies with breast implants where they've been dislodged or moved. I see someone for that every couple months.
Yeah. There's been some news about the potential risks associated with breast implants and certain types of lymphoma. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Sure. That's a newer development in the last 3 years. But just recently in the news, it's been called breast implant-associated lymphoma, and it's associated with a certain subset of silicone implant or textured implants, which is the type of shell that's around they place in certain implants. It's only associated with the textured implant, not a smooth implant. And the numbers are very small. However, just 2 weeks ago, the FDA recommended and the company Allergan agreed to take all those textured implants off the market.
I see. And what percentage of the breast implants that you're doing are augmentation versus reconstruction after, let's say, cancer surgery?
I do some reconstructive breast surgery, but probably 90% of my practice is doing cosmetic.
Augmentation.
Yes.
Now, Dr. Bundrick, you do a fair amount of reconstructive surgery, particularly after cancer, do you not?
Absolutely. That's a huge part of my practice.
Tell our listeners a little bit more about that.
So a lot of my practice is cancer reconstructive surgery. Being in Louisiana, everyone's exposed to the sun. We have a very large skin cancer population. And so the bulk of my practice is the cancer is removed by a dermatologist who removes it in a very specific way, cell layer by cell layer. And then he sends it to me to close the wound. Wounds on the face, unlike other areas of the body, you know, we have limited tissue. And so the closure of the wound is very artistic and very geometric. So I design flaps that are elevated off of the face, and I move them into the defect. And the purpose of the design is to avoid any distortion or pull on the other features of the face, like the eyelids or the lips or the nose. And so a lot of thought is put into the reconstruction of the skin cancer defects.
You mentioned the word flap. What exactly is a flap?
So a flap is basically I lift a flap of skin or a design in I design a pattern in a skin surrounding where the skin cancer was, and I lift it up and I move it into the defect. And this allows me to close the wound without distorting other facial features.
I see. And do sometimes those flaps or other parts of tissue come from other places?
They can. So I can move skin from the forehead and bring it down onto the nose. And that's one of the most common flaps that I do. The reason that we do that is the skin on the nose doesn't stretch.
Yeah.
And so we have to get skin from somewhere to close the wound.
Okay. And so your training is in ear, nose, and throat surgery as well as with cosmetics. So I imagine this is kind of a coupling of both, the kind of the cancer surgery, cancer operation, but then also with consideration for the cosmetic aspect. So so how would somebody know, let's say they have a skin cancer on their face, they're diagnosed by a dermatologist, you know, how would they know, let's say I should go to a general ENT, I should go to a dermatologist, I should go to a facial plastics, you know, how does someone make that decision?
Well, you know, it is your face. And so I think that is the benefit of coming to a board-certified facial plastic surgeon is that, you know, this is something that I do every day. My goal is to make you feel like yourself again. You know, anyone can plug a hole and you may not look like you did before. I think that's part of my passions in life is making people feel whole again.
Okay. Now, along those lines, let's say, for example, let's say I have a teenage daughter. She suffers a laceration, a cut, a significant cut on her face, middle of the night, goes into the emergency room. you know, they want to sew it up, but I'm thinking, you know, I want to make sure this has the best cosmetic result possible. Do plastic surgeons take call where they would come in and take care of something like that, as opposed to have it sewn up, let's say, by the emergency room doctor? Or, you know, in a situation like that, do you, you know, consider scar revisions if the scars don't heal nicely?
I think that's a great point, Sandy. At Ochsner LSU Health System, we have plastic surgeons on call 24 hours a day. The doctors that I work with, we're always on call. It may not be me, it may be one of my partners, but we're all trained in facial plastic surgery. And so that's why I do feel like in a traumatic situation, our emergency room really is a safe bet, because trauma is something that we see a lot of and we're really good at. And, you know, it's not just nothing against ER doctors, but it's not going to be the ER doctor sewing you up. It's going to be one of my colleagues. And we are trained to do a beautiful job and create a beautiful scar. Now, should you have a bad scar, don't lose hope. Scar revision is also a huge part of my practice. You know, there are lots of different techniques that I use. Sometimes I have to remove the scar. Sometimes it's wide. Sometimes it's depressed. Sometimes it's raised. And as a plastic surgeon, the way that we perform our suturing is very specific and very meticulous to create a very flat, narrow scar. There's also different techniques where I can move the scar around by releasing the skin to hide it in natural creases, you know, like your eyelid, you know, your crow's feet or forehead wrinkles, things like that.
Very good. Dr. Wall, we were talking a bit about reconstruction. We talked about reconstructions for breasts after breast cancer. Dr. Bunder talking about reconstruction after cancer surgery. Many people don't know that that some plastic surgeons actually do hand surgery, and I understand that you've got specialized training in hand surgery. How does that fit into plastic surgery in general?
Basically, in the history of plastic surgery, the way we started, pretty much plastic surgeons took over whatever no one else wanted to do. So years ago, people didn't want to do burns. People didn't want to do hands. People didn't want to do reconstruction. So the plastic surgeons pretty much were pioneers in all those fields. And there's still a very large number of plastic surgeons that do hand surgery. I went to California, did a hand and microsurgery fellowship, where mostly we put fingers and toes back on, or reconstructed hands, mutilated hands, and
crush injuries, things like that.
Large injuries, yes.
Wow, that's fantastic.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
We have another caller on the line who's been patiently waiting. This is, well, I don't have a name, so this is an unknown caller. Welcome to Health Matters. Are you still there? Maybe not so patient. Okay, well, call back if you, we'll get you back on the air. Okay, so you mentioned, Dr. Wall, about breast augmentation, breast reduction, breast lift. What about, let's say, teenagers or girls who have symmetry problems? At what point would one consider having a surgical procedure to correct that, and what would be an ideal age?
That's really a good question. I really depend when they I see that quite often in my practice. Young girls, very self-conscious, usually in high school, embarrassed to get undressed with their friends or in the gym. And the question always is, when should we do anything to correct that? And I take it on an individual basis, because some ladies mature at a different rate than others. Now, I just did a girl last month that was 16, and she had a very big difference in her breasts and was very self-conscious about it. So she hasn't grown since she was 13. So it had been 3 years. And we went ahead and proceeded so she could get her symmetry problem corrected before she got into college.
Very good. So it's interesting. You talk about being self-conscious, particularly in the locker room, or I imagine, you know, intimacy issues. You know, you just...
Hopefully not the 16-year-old.
Well, eventually. I mean, yeah, the breasts aren't... Correct. They're not going anywhere. They're not going to normalize, right? So, but in any event, Dr. Bundrick mentioned about bullying with the ears, and that can be covered by insurance, potentially, maybe.
As infants.
As infants. Now, are these sort of things often covered by insurance for symmetry issues?
You sound like the parents from that patient just a couple weeks ago. In that instance, they were not covered.
They were not. And what about if someone needs a breast reduction? At what point does that become a medical versus a cosmetic procedure?
Well, in my estimation, if you fit a certain criteria, which is usually a pound of breast tissue in each breast, you should be covered. But in the state we live in, with the insurance companies we deal with, a lot of these patients don't get denied or excluded from having breast reductions, even if they're medically necessary or warranted. The biggest carrier of private insurance in the state is Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they have been excluding breast reductions for countless years and won't even respond.
I see. So are there any implications when doing breast surgery in terms of, let's say, lactation? Is there any impact on lactation if you have a breast reduction or augmentation, any other concerns after having a surgery like that somebody should know about?
I tell, because I get quite a few number of younger girls with breast reductions, and what I tell the patients is there's a 50-50 chance you won't be able to breastfeed once you try, and you won't know until you try.
I see. And what about having to have subsequent surgeries to, let's say, replace those breast implants?
Well, you're asking very difficult questions.
That's my job.
The standard book answer, if you go online and look at the websites, is that you need to, on average, the breast implants are replaced every 10 years. In my experience, that's not the case with my patients. But what they're doing is looking at all the patients in a whole set of patients that are dissatisfied that want to change out implants, patients that have a ruptured implant, patients that have scar issues or contractures or whatever. For whatever reason, they look at all those patients. And then out of all those patients, on average, someone has it done within 10 years. Most of my patients, I've been doing this 20 years, and 95% of my patients still have the same set of implants that they have.
And what about size? Bigger is better. How do you gauge when somebody comes in, what would be an appropriate size for them? Or what if, you know, they want a really big size that, you know, at what point do you say, maybe this isn't the best choice for you? How does one decide?
Well, first of all, we live in this area, Northwest Louisiana, East Texas, and Southern California are the areas in the country where they have the largest set of implants used on average, is at least two sections.
Percentage of women who have been augmented or largest breasts?
Largest implants. They pick larger implants here than anywhere else in the country.
I see. Everything's big in Texas.
Yes.
And Louisiana.
And
okay.
Southern California. So I basically, to answer your questions, I let the patients decide. I have a way I do it in the office. They come in and they try on, and we go over in detail what's going to make you happy. And I let the patients decide. I don't let the patient's husband decide. I don't let the patient's mother decide. I let the patient decide. And that way, usually, you have a successful, happy patient at the end of the procedure. Every now and then, there's an extreme. And in the last year, I had the extremes on both sides within the last year. And one was the smallest implants I've ever put in. And the other one was I had to put stacked implants, which means she got two sets of implants just to make these people happy. So I don't have a set number or pick for myself. I let the patients decide
what makes them happy.
Right.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
So, Dr. Brundrick, in terms of making people happy, there's a lot of Botox, a lot of fillers, I understand, very popular. And the age, it seems like people are getting or pursuing this at younger and younger ages. What do you think is, why do you think this is? What's accounting for this increase in interest in these procedures?
You know, Sandy, the overall and of all surgical procedures, facial procedures in, across the board have increased. Rhinoplasties, Botox, fillers, and I think it's because of selfies. And I think it's because of the social media age. Your face is everywhere. You know, these young kids are, they're always taking selfies and putting themselves on Instagram and Snapchat and these things. And so I think that really is contributing to people's self-awareness.
Are you familiar with Snapchat dysmorphia?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
So it's like I was talking about. It's I'm actually not on Snapchat, but they have these filters. So apparently you can change your appearance with just the click of a button on your iPhone. And it can make you look, make your skin smoother and your lips bigger and your eyes more gooey. And people get in their heads that this is what they look like. And then they actually see a picture of themselves and they're shocked that they don't look like this Snapchat filter. And I think there's an element of depression that goes with it.
Do they ever come in and show you the picture of the Snapchat modified picture and say, I want to look like this?
I have seen that before. And, you know, people will come in and say, well, this is what I look like. And it's obviously a filter.
Yeah.
And it's not what you look like, unfortunately.
Right.
It's pretty sad, actually, that I call it the Kardashian effect.
Yeah.
It's just unreasonable appearance that people think they're supposed to look like. And it's actually depresses me because you're dealing with someone who's already has a low self-esteem, and then they want to make themselves look even more
right
different.
You know, that's a very important topic, and I wanted to cover that.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
I do want to first address Christine's call. She's here to ask a question. Christine, welcome to Health Matters.
Oh, thank you. I had a question about complications from breast implants. You know, in recent times, we've heard about breast cancer because it's not certain kinds of implants that they have. And I just wanted to know, like, what other complications for someone who was really thinking about it? Is it something that we should be precautions about or things to consider? Because I'm pretty sure even then those ladies didn't think about that this could possibly cause cancer. Or is there a certain kind or a certain technique or something that things should, you know, questions to ask?
Okay, so Dr. Wall, what do you think?
Well, Christine, I think you're talking about the breast implant associated lymphoma, which has been in the news a lot in the last month. And basically, to sum it up, it's only really associated with one type of implant, which is a textured implant. And it's really only coming from one company that textures these implants. And the risk to you, if you're not, and they've taken those implants off the market, so the risk to you is almost zero nowadays, because I've never put any of those implants in ever, so I'm quite confident. Every patient that calls my office gets told the same thing, that you don't have to worry. I never put those implants in, but I would guess most doctors around here that were putting those type of implants in are now back to putting the smooth implants in. And so as far as cancer or lymphoma, I would say that it approaches, but not definitely zero, approaches 0% chance that you could get that.
Okay, so it's good that we don't have that to worry about anymore. Thank you, Christine. Now, before Christine called in, we were talking a little bit about, psychological issues with people pursuing plastic surgery and wanting to augment or enhance or at least alter their appearance. So how do you gauge when somebody comes to you and they want to alter their appearance that they're unhappy with some aspect of themselves or their lives, but it's not necessarily really their appearance as much as it may be some other aspect of themselves? How do you gauge that? And how do you address that with a person?
To me, you know, I look for a couple of red flags. Some people come in and they think that their facelift is going to be a cure-all. You know, my life is going to get better, you know, once I get this facelift, or he's going to want me back. Or if it's associated with a specific traumatic event, like a divorce or something like that, you know, I think a psychological evaluation is a valuable thing. You know, plastic surgery in general can be associated with an element of depression. And before you embark on a surgery like this, making sure that you're in a good emotional state is a fair thing to do.
Okay. And Dr. Wall?
I agree with everything Dr. Brunswick said. I should add, throw in that there is a subsect of patients that I always am concerned about, and I think it's throughout all of our fields, is the male rhinoplasty patient. Those patients, typically you have to go in there with a little skepticism because they are the most difficult to please. And they're also the most prone to having secondary and tertiary surgeries or revisions. So every male rhinoplasty patient that comes in my office, I always interview and give them a really good thorough exam to make sure that I think they're going to be pleased with if they have anything done.
Now, would that be true for someone with a nose as big as mine, or would you say, okay, I mean, you know, my concern about him is he didn't come in earlier?
I think Dr. Brunswick and I would both have to work on you to help you out.
Very good. And hopefully you wouldn't charge me by the inch. So, all right. Now, so what about if somebody's coming for multiple surgeries, you know, kind of a frequent flyer? At some point, I mean, does that raise a red flag as well?
I think so. You know, other red flags for me is, have they had multiple rhinoplasty surgeries in the past? That's a scary nose to tackle, and it's a sign that, you know, they may not be that easy to please. So previous surgeries or multiple previous surgeries, and, you know, a patient who is unhappy about very minuscule things.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like the TV shows that are very popular, all these plastic surgery, quote-unquote, reality shows, seem to have people who are having lots of revisions, seems to be a lot in California-based type stuff. Do you think overall that those shows are good for the field, or you think that they've been harmful for the field?
I think they're very misleading because all they show are the complications in the unhappy patients, where probably 98%, 97% of the patients are very happy and don't have revisions. So they're getting a very small subset of patients either that are unhappy or ones that just want to be on TV.
I agree with that. I mean, you don't know the patient's past history. And it's easy to say, well, some doctor did this to me, but we didn't get the full story about what happened in their post-operative course. Maybe, you know, they were smoking cigarettes and
right.
They didn't heal perfectly because of that.
Right.
You know, that's a huge factor in your outcome in plastic surgery. Is the patient going to be compliant in their specifically tobacco use?
Yeah.
You know, that's a big reason people will have complications and imperfect results is noncompliance.
Yeah. That was one of the things that always bothers me about those shows is that it seems like the doctors on those shows are very quick to criticize the other doctors who perhaps were involved in that patient's care, which I just don't think that's very professional in general. So I don't like those shows.
One of my best friends is a plastic surgeon in Orange County, California, and he takes care of a lot of complications from some of those doctors that are on those shows.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You know, another thing I don't want to give people the impression I watch these shows all the time, but I do research for when I do these, you know, radio shows. So, But one of the things that kind of struck me is that it seems like labiaplasty, if you watch these shows, seems to be, you know, very popular, very rampant. How common is that? And when did this start?
So I've seen labiaplasties throughout my career since the late 90s. And I used to do a lot generally up until about 3 or 4 years ago, where I think the other practitioners have, that are like gynecologists, have found out about that and learned, are willing to do those procedures. So the number of labiaplasties I see are a lot less than they used to be.
I see.
Because I think other
people are doing it.
Yes.
So this is basically when women are unhappy with the appearance of their vagina, and specifically the labia, and they want it smaller.
Well, that's where it started.
Yeah.
And nowadays they have all these new machines that are also supposed to rejuvenate the vagina, which makes it theoretically tighter and more sensual.
But that's different than actually surgically altering the appearance of your vagina.
But that's where they're going now with it. They're doing the whole thing of everything. Yes.
So, I mean, it's that I read that there was the theory is that over time, with the elimination of the pubic hair, people have been noticing their vaginas more and saying, you know, this doesn't look like it's supposed to look like in the adult films, and somehow this is becoming a thing. But do you find that in general, from the statistics that you read, that this is a more commonly performed procedure now?
It's actually getting bigger and bigger. The last major meeting I went to, I took a course on labiaplasty that had never been offered before. So yes, by that, it's getting bigger. But it's not just getting them smaller. People are wanting them rejuvenated. So we're doing fat injections and fillers and
PRP
and all different kinds of procedures. And then there's also, to go to a little bit lower, there's the anal bleaching and that stuff. Thank you, Michael.
Yeah. Okay. And then, Dr. Bundrick, now you do lip injections.
Absolutely.
And I guess you both do lip injections. I apologize. But you do lip injections, I know. And, you know, I've seen some lips that get them pretty big.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, is there a point at which you start to worry about some sort of complication or functional impairment of these lips?
Well, there gets to be a point where I do start to worry about something called body dysmorphic disorder. I like big lips. I think they're beautiful. I like my lips big. I get, you know, a little filler in my own lips. But I don't like to do it to a point where it's obviously fake. And I have had a few people where I've had to say, you know what, I think we're going too far. And, you know, it's time to stop. You know, I think the Kardashians and a lot of the social media people do tend to get addicted to these things.
You know, the Kardashians seem like they've really had a negative impact, in terms of people's sense of what they should look like and how they should feel about themselves. So this show is certainly not is not in praise of them. But, you know, they have their, I'm sure they're nice people.
There are. And I'll tell you another procedure that I do really love is the surgical lip lift. So, you know, our upper lip tends to age just like the rest of our face, becoming elongated. And so by removing some of the skin just below the nose, it picks up on the red lip and it kind of curls it out and gives the appearance of it being a little bit bigger. And it's really a powerful maneuver. It can be absolutely gorgeous in the right patient. And the benefit of it is that it's permanent. With lip fillers, you do have to come in the clinic and, you know, get them every 4 to 6 months because they do wear off. They're metabolized by the body. But the surgical lip lift is a permanent solution to the aging of the upper lip. Another thing that I do is facial fat injections, and that's another permanent option.
You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Health Matters. No phone calls will be taken tonight.
And, you know, a lot of this, I guess, is mostly women having these procedures performed. Dr. Wall, you did mention that there are some men that you do procedures on, and I know, Dr. Bundrick, that you do as well, I guess, particularly with the blepharoplasties.
Absolutely.
Are there other procedures in men that are very common, or let's say, are there age-specific procedures that men tend to get when they're younger versus when they're older?
Well, you know, Sandy, I'd like to say that facial rejuvenation and having pride in your face is not something that is exclusive to women.
But statistically, it's
more common, but more and more often I'm seeing men in my office for facial rejuvenation. They want to feel good about themselves, too. They want to look like they feel. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, and I don't think we should create a stigma.
Certainly was not my implication that there was a stigma. Just was curious as to what the referral patterns are and what people are pursuing. You know, we always think about a lot, at least I do, is hair restoration with men. I know that's something that you see advertised a lot. Is that something that y'all do?
I used to do it, but I find it very tedious, and I don't have the patience for it. So I usually send them to other people that have more patience than I do for that, because it's a very tedious, long procedure for doing micro plugs. And there's businesses out there that's all they do.
Yeah.
And it's a great procedure, and they have lots of newer techniques that they're doing. I just don't choose not to do it, but I think it's a great procedure. And to add what you were saying earlier, every year we're seeing more and more men in our office asking for cosmetic improvement or wherever. And I think it's the baby boomers. They're all getting older and they're flooding our offices.
Yeah.
Men and women.
Yeah. But Dr. Mundrick, I guess, you know, I guess there is a little bit of a stigma, I guess, for men, right? Men are not, I guess the macho man is not supposed to care about what they look like necessarily. But as you said, I mean, it's just a matter of taking care of yourself and taking pride in your appearance.
That's right.
So do you do the hair restoration?
So I am trained in hair restoration. There are a couple of different techniques that are available. One is the basically called a strip technique, where we take a strip of hair from the back of the head, and we have a technician come in where they dice it up into the individual hair follicles, and I implant it into the hairline and recreate the hairline. So that's a great technique. One of the newer techniques available is they have machines that harvest the specific hair follicle individually. So it individually, through the back of the hair, we'll pluck out the individual hair follicles, and we use those and reimplant them in the front of the hairline. That is my next goal for my practice, is to get one of those machines. I think it's an awesome way to rejuvenize the hairline. It avoids a scar on the back of the head. With a male who wears his hair short, you know, can be visible. So that'll be our next investment.
Nice. And what about women with hair loss?
So female hair loss is a common problem. You know, there are hair transplant is definitely an option for women who have hereditary hair loss. You know, obviously you want to come in and get an evaluation to make sure there's not a medical reason that you're having hair loss, like a thyroid problem or iron or an autoimmune issue. There are other options as well. There's something called PRP, where you spin down the blood and inject it into the hairline. This isn't something that I offer. Do you offer it, Dr. Wall?
No, I don't.
I know that Arklatex Dermatology is offering it, and I think Kenny Sanders as well in town is offering it, and it's a great procedure.
Is this like a stem cell-based treatment, or what is it in the blood
you're spinning
isolating?
Down different growth factors. It's called platelet-rich plasma, and it unfortunately doesn't work for everyone. I think, you know, individual results may vary, but if you are not willing to undergo a surgical procedure, then, you know, may want to consider it.
Wow. Sounds pretty exciting.
There's also some other light therapy.
Yeah.
They're trying the blue lights and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I checked into all that a couple of years ago.
Does it work?
It has its place. I would say if you're going to go through the expense of doing all this, I would do everything.
Okay. In the time we have left, we only have a few more minutes, but two topics I think that are very popular I want to ask about is the mommy makeover you hear a lot about. What exactly is the mommy makeover?
Well, typically it's a woman who's done with having their children, and hopefully has gotten in the best shape they can get in and is dissatisfied with their breasts and their abdomens, typically. And there's other areas that can be included too, but probably 90% of them, it's those two areas. And they want their breast back where they used to be, or larger, or lifted, and their tummy's flatter, and the muscles tightened at the abdomen. So that's probably the most increasing part of population I'm seeing in patients is the mommy makeover, where they're doing combined procedures of the breast and the abdomen, along with some liposuction or something else.
What's the recovery time from something like that?
Well, the typical patient has some young kids, and they don't have a lot of time to recover. So I get them back, most hopefully, in 2 weeks, back to driving around the kids and doing daily activities. I limit their physical activity for 4 to 6 weeks. But they're up driving around and doing what they need to do within 2 weeks.
Now, does it matter if they've had a cesarean section or not?
No, that doesn't matter.
Doesn't make a difference. Okay. And what's the procedure where you tighten up the under portion of the arms?
That's called a brachioplasty. Most of those patients that I do have had significant weight loss, and they have a whole excess skin or bat wing of skin where we cut it off and leave a scar. There's also, if the skin's tight, and this is why you have to come in and be seen, then you can just do liposuction. There are some areas, if they're just small areas, like in the armpit or something that they're worried about, there has people talk about what we were going to talk about as the Kybella.
Yeah.
I would limit that a lot because...
Can you explain what Kybella is?
So Kybella is it's something that's been out there a long time, but this company repackaged it and came up with a way to market it where it's an acid that they inject in areas of fat that will dissolve the fat. It's FDA approved for the area under the chin, but they're also doing it in other areas off label, so to speak. I can talk about that. I'm not representing the company. The downside of the Kybella, though, is that it's very, very expensive, and you have to usually do it more than once.
So not your favorite procedure?
No, it's not my favorite procedure.
Okay.
And I've told the company that several times.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We've talked a lot about some really very interesting and exciting procedures and options for people. And so I guess one of the things I just want to stress is that if you are considering one of these procedures, to go and have a consultation, but that it should be with somebody who's specifically trained and board certified in a plastic surgery specialty or subspecialty. And with that, I'd like to once again thank you, Dr. Wall, and you, Dr. Bundrick, for coming in and spending your time here and providing your expertise to our listeners.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Dr. Katz.
Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. Consult your physician or healthcare provider for all health concerns. Views and opinions expressed by guests on Health Matters do not necessarily reflect those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or staff. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org.